Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to We Are History with me, Angela Barnes.
And me, John O'Farrell.
Now, John, being our resident feminist We Are History, you'll no doubt be aware that there's a certain special day coming up this week.
Yes, yes, it's British Pie Week, Angela.
Yes, yes, it is British Pie Week, John, but what is even more important than that?
More important than pies?
Well, equally important then.
Yes, I know this because I'm such a good feminist. It is, of course, International Women's Day.
That's right, John. Well done.
So, ladies, I hope you're going to spend International Women's Day baking an extra special pie for the man in your life to celebrate.
Very funny, John. Some humble pie for you, I think.
Very good, the way she comes back.
She's feisty, that one. Watch her.
Feisty redhead Angela Barnes is going to talk to me.
Great stuff. All the women have now turned off, so we're talking just to the men now. I thought it'd be nice, John, rather than do an International Women's Day special, let's just look at the history of International Women's Day itself, how it came about, how it sparked an actual revolution. Wow. Did you know that?
And you are sure you're right to do this? You don't want me to take the lead, Angela?
I'll tell you what, John, shall we see how I get on? And you can always step in if you think I'm struggling.
That's a good idea. Well, if you say something, I'll just say it louder with more
confidence.
That's
it, yeah. Then people will know it's true if you say it. That's happened to me so many times in my life.
That's happened to you so many times, Angela.
Oh, God, this is going to be such a long record. Right, let's crack on. So, International Women's Day, as we know it, John, it really rose in popularity with second wave feminism back in the 60s and 70s. Yep. But, did you know, it actually goes back over 100 years.
Cool.
And what I think a lot of people might not know is that prior to the 60s, it was predominantly a holiday observed in communist countries.
Okay.
So let's go back, John.
Oh, here we go.
Not too far. Not too far this time. Just to the late 19th, early 20th century, when there were these sort of global movements at the time for women's suffrage.
Yes.
And at the same time, there were also global labour and trade union movements to represent the rights of workers in a post-industrialised society.
Yeah, we talked about this in our episode on the anti-suffrage movement, which I was very keen to do. But just to recap on that, the feminist movement was something very separate from the socialist movements of the labour and trade union movements of the time, because it was mostly for women's votes on equal rights with men at that time. So basically posh women.
Yeah.
So the socialists were like, well, we don't want more posh voters. We want majority working class voters. Mm. So throughout the world, people on the left associated women's votes with being conservative.
Yeah, absolutely. The feminist movement as it was then was concerned more with the political rather than the social. So it was about enfranchisement, about getting the vote and holding political office. It wasn't about women's rights in the home, workplace, gender-based violence, any of the other million issues that feminism as we know it today encompasses. And so it wasn't really about the concerns of working class women.
No, the socialist and labour movements, they were representing the rights of the working classes, ostensibly for men and women.
Yeah, and socialists felt that women's political rights were subordinate, really, to the rights of the working class as a whole. So they felt that the class struggle sort of trumped the equal rights struggle, because it's more important at that time to achieve enfranchisement for the working classes, that is working class men,
yes,
getting the vote, than that of middle and upper class women.
Yes, it feels like working class women are getting left out of this.
Yeah.
It was the time of the Second International, an organisation that brought together socialist and labour parties across the world and provided a platform for these movements to coordinate actions and strategies internationally. Very long meetings. There had been a first international known as the International Working Men's Association.
Yeah, a bit of a clue there to their priorities.
Yes, but then it collapsed due to tension between the Marxist faction and the anarchist factions. I mean, who would have thought it?
I know, ever thus on the left, isn't it? Yeah, ever thus. You've got that scene from Monty Python.
Yeah, yeah.
The
Splitters.
Judean Popular People's Front.
And
absolutely. Yeah. So the Second International was established in Paris on the 14th of July, 1889, which was a pretty important anniversary, John.
Was that French International Pie Week?
Well, it might have been. But it was also the 100th anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, of course. And then in 1907, during the Stuttgart Congress of the Second International, the International Women's Socialist Movement was founded.
So that's quite a significant milestone, isn't it? Because And now the issue of women's equality is finally beginning to be officially recognised within the international socialist movement.
That's right. But let's head for now, John, to America.
Okay.
In New York, we find a woman whose name was Teresa Malkiel. And she originally came from what is now Ukraine.
Right.
But she fled with her family to New York, like so many others, to avoid persecution for being Jewish. And from the age of 17, she worked in New York as a cloak maker in a garment factory on the Lower East Side.
The Lower East Side.
The Lower East Side. I can't do it. Coffee. Coffee
on the Lower East Side.
So she organised the Infant Cloakmakers Union of New York, and she gradually became introduced to socialist ideas through her work with the union. And eventually she joined the Socialist Party of America.
Wow.
And then she made history by being the first woman who had actually been a factory worker, actually coming from that background, to rise to a leadership position within the Socialist Party of America.
Right. And like other socialist organisations, while the Socialist Party of America was committed in principle to equal rights for men and women, it never really made a specific effort to reach out to female workers and showed little interest in their particular concerns. Is that fair?
That's right, yeah. And Malkiel could see this. But she realised that socialist women would have to fight their own battle for equality alongside this larger labour struggle for the working classes.
Right.
And she wrote an essay in 1909 called Where Do We Stand on the Women Question? And no job before you ask the woman question is not Does My Bum Look Big in This?
I was never going to say that. I actually got an extract from her essay here, Angela. For the working woman of today finds herself between two fires. On the one hand, she faces the capitalist class, her bitterest enemy. It foresees a far-reaching danger in her emancipation, and with all the ability of its money power, tries to resist her eventual advent into the civilized world. In her anguish, the working woman turns towards her brothers in the hope to find a strong support in their midst. But she is doomed to be disillusioned, for they discourage her activity and are utterly listless towards the outcome of her struggle.
Lucky all this has been fixed, isn't it?
You know,
it isn't really an issue today.
Yeah, that's great. It's lucky it's all sorted.
Wonderful. So while officially the Socialist Party was opposed to separatism, Malkiel felt it was actually necessary to highlight in particular the struggle for women, and that doing so would then attract more women to the Socialist Party of America.
And women within the party were getting frustrated because they wanted more agency. She felt their role could go beyond being, you know, official cake bakers and money collectors.
Yeah, it seems being a woman in the socialist movement before this time was a bit like having to do the teas for your husband's cricket match.
I'm not sure it's changed a lot since.
No, probably not.
The Christmas fair at, you know, the Lambeth Labour Party is still the women
do
baking the cakes.
And do the teas, and we'll sort out the important politic business.
Yes.
But she believed, Teresa Malkiel, that only socialism could truly liberate women. So she did believe in the cause and that it would have this effect.
Yeah.
And that socialism itself couldn't survive without the full participation of women, that it was imperative that women were allowed to fully participate. So in 1909, she was elected to the Women's National Committee of the Socialist Party. They love a committee on the left.
They do. We
just
love
a committee. And it was here that she decided to establish an annual National Women's Day.
Oh, so this is the woman who gave birth, as it were.
Well, kind of, yeah.
Fantastic. National Women's Day, though, you say, not International Women's
Day. Yeah, at this point, it's a bit like the World Series, I suppose, in baseball. It's a good idea, but it's just for America.
Yeah. They say the world, but they mean them.
Yeah. So National Women's Day was to take place on the last Sunday in February, and its main purpose would be to highlight the issue of women's suffrage.
Okay, it had to take place on a Sunday, of course, so that people wouldn't have to miss a day of work to attend.
Yeah, absolutely. And in New York on the 23rd of February 1909, over 2,000 people gathered for this International Women's Day, National Women's Day,
yes.
I should say, just in America. And they gathered to hear the feminist suffragist and trade union organiser Leonora O'Reilly explain the principles behind equal rights and to demand votes for women.
Right, and the humanist and novelist Charlotte Perkins Gilman addressed the congregation of a church in Brooklyn, saying, "It is true that a woman's duty is centred in her home and motherhood." But she said, "Home should mean the whole country and not be confined to three or four rooms or a city or a state."
Quite a big deal to be saying something like that in a church
good for
at
her.
That time.
Yeah, excellent.
And then they did it again the following year, again on the last Sunday in February in 1910. And this time the rally opened at Carnegie Hall.
Wow, okay.
With the 2,000 strong congregation singing the Marseillaise.
Wow. So yeah. The National Women's Day was born. So, Angela, tell us how it went global.
Well, for that, we go to Copenhagen in 1910, where ahead of a general meeting of the Second International, an international socialist women's meeting was held with representatives from socialist movements across the world. And one of them was a German Marxist theorist called Clara Zetkin. Don't know if you know her. She was friends with Rosa Luxemburg.
She's last in my address book.
Yeah. Last in everyone's address book, to be fair. And she was a leading figure in the Social Democratic Party in Germany and in the international socialist movement.
She'd actually been there at the 100th anniversary of the Bastille and had played a key role in establishing the Second International back in 1889.
Yeah, she was a really prominent socialist of the time. She was editor of the German Social Democratic Party's Women's newspaper, which was called Gleichheit, which means equality.
Yeah.
And she was at the forefront of the argument that this struggle for women's liberation was integral to the broader struggle for socialism. So she was really instrumental in integrating feminist perspectives into these Marxist theories.
In this magazine. It was a bit like Chat or Take a Break.
Yeah, oh God, John.
So pictures of women
tips
socialists.
What to do with your used carrier bag?
Look at the cellulite on Rosa. Oh, friends fear she's been drinking custard again.
Oh, you are going to feminist hell, John.
So she fought for the women's rights outside the legal and political reforms that the suffrage movement was about. And she knew emancipation required social and economic change to happen too.
Yeah, not just votes for women.
Absolutely.
So at this meeting, Clara Zetkin proposed an annual International Women's Day based on what had been happening in America as an annual day of action to advocate for women's rights. Now, they didn't specify a date, but the following year, 1911, the very first International Women's Day was held in Europe on the 18th of March.
Right. And that date marked the 40th anniversary of the Paris Commune.
Yes.
Listen to our podcast on the Siege of Paris, which touches on that. Mm-hmm. The radical socialist and revolutionary government that briefly ruled Paris from March the 18th to May the 28th in 1871.
That's right. And over a million people in Austria, Denmark, Germany and Switzerland came together to mark this first International Women's Day.
Yeah. In Vienna, women marched around the Ringstrasse. Do you like my German accent there?
I'll do.
Carrying banners, including red flags, commemorating the martyrs of the Paris Commune.
There were over 300 demonstrations across the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And on that day, in the Austrian Parliament, it was the first time that the socialist delegates to the Parliament openly championed women's equality and suffrage. And these events, they began to take place annually across Europe and still in the US as well.
International Women's Day had no set date, of course, but it was generally celebrated in late February, early March. And that is why the mimosa is the flower of International Women's Day. And I've got a lovely big mimosa flowering in my garden now, and it gets pointed out to me that it's celebrating International Women's Day. But anyway, in the US, they continued their tradition of holding their day on the last Sunday of February.
I believe that was, I'm trying to think where, I think it's in Bulgaria or somewhere that the mimosa was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it wasn't in America. It was in a right. Warsaw Pact sort of.
It's sort of recognised now as the sort of international flower of the Women's Day, wouldn't we?
Jack has been dishing them out
to everyone, going, here, I have this for International Women's Day. Cutting off great big branches. I should have brought you some, Angela. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. You can make me a mimosa. Flower mimosas make me sneeze, but I'll have a mimosa. So then in 1913, led by feminist Alexandra Kollontai, the first International Women's Day celebration in Russia happened.
Okay.
And I think that's a good place to take a break, John, because my husband's due home from work and I've got to get his dinner on the table.
Well, it's quite right too.
So let's do that.
Hello and welcome back to We Are History, where Angela is going on and on and on about International Women's
Day. You're so brave, John. I've got a hot cup of tea in my hand. You're really brave right now.
So tell us about
it. So, after a couple of years of the annual International Women's Day, socialism was starting to get on board with the importance of the fight for women's rights. But then, John, another sort of fight came along, didn't it?
Wars. Oh, thank God we're back to war.
Big old war.
We're off. feminist
World
politics.
War One.
Oh, now I can tell you a lot about the origin. Different sorts of tanks in World War One.
Brilliant. Oh God. Now we've piqued John's interest. Yes, the Great War came along.
Yeah, and this presented a huge crisis for the Second International. The member parties had pledged to oppose militarism and war, supporting international solidarity among workers instead. But in reality, when war broke out, most socialist parties across Europe rallied behind their respective governments.
Yeah, and this caused a big rift in the Second International. Another one, John.
Oh, God.
Especially when the German Social Democratic Party voted to back Germany's war effort.
Ooh.
Bit awkward. Well, there was a minority faction within the German Social Democratic Party that included Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht and people like that that opposed the war. But the betrayal of what was seen as fundamental socialist principles led to the collapse of this Second International, and it formally dissolved in 1916.
Right. But the war, of course, didn't stop women taking action for equality. Many suffragists and socialists felt the war itself demonstrated a pretty good reason for women to have the vote. Would women have voted to let the war happen?
Well, quite. The socialist playwright Marion Craig Wentworth, she wrote a play called War Brides that was very famous. And in it, a pregnant war widow commits suicide rather than bear more children for a nation that won't allow her a say in its decision-making. There was a picture in the New York Call of a mother and child against this sort of war-torn background, and the caption asks whether women would vote for this if they had the vote. And it's a pretty good point. It reminds me of the argument that men's rights activists always put forward. You know, that equality's all very well, but we're the ones who have to go and fight and die in wars. And I think the best response that I've ever seen was a comment on the internet, and it just said, "I'll go and fight and die in wars that are started by women."
Right. And generally those men don't fight in wars anyway. They
they're just
sitting at home on their
mum's
keyboards.
Basement. Yeah.
Yeah, trolling women. So in March 1915... Clara Zetkin organised an international women's conference in Bern in Switzerland, where she got women together from warring and neutral countries to demonstrate against the war.
Yeah, this is a big deal, because these women attending this meeting, these protesters, the ones that are coming from the belligerent nations, they're effectively committing treason against their own countries just by going to this meeting in Switzerland.
And they called for the Second International to be reconstituted and address the particular social and political challenge for women in wartime and the impact of the war on living conditions and employment.
Yeah, the socialist women in Bern then took their manifesto from the meeting back to their own countries and distributed it, clandestinely, of course.
Right.
And it was addressed to the women of the proletariat, and it asked, "Where are your husbands? Where are your sons?" And it said, "Workers have nothing to gain from the war. They have everything to lose, everything, everything that is dear to them." So it was a, you know, quite a dangerous manoeuvre. In fact, there was the French socialist Louise Sumanel. She was actually jailed in November in 1915 for distributing this manifesto back in France.
Right, but the war continued. And the socialist celebration of International Women's Day also continued throughout this period.
Yeah. The war was causing food shortages, of course, for all the nations that were involved. So when International Women's Day came around, that was a focal point. So, for example, in New York that year, when it came around, the women came together to call for support to feed their families.
Yes. On International Women's Day in Turin, in Italy, in 1917, female socialists hung posters addressed to women in working-class neighbourhoods that said, "Hasn't there been enough torment from this war? Now the food necessary for our children has begun to disappear. It is time for us to act in the name of suffering humanity. Our cry is, down with arms. We are part of the same family. We want peace. We must show that women can protect those who depend on them."
Yeah. I think it's fair to say, though, John, that probably the most dramatic celebration of International Women's Day took place in 1917 in Russia.
Did anything happen in Russia in 1917?
Not much, no, pretty quiet, I think, in Russia in 1917.
Many women in Russia were sort of active among the revolutionary socialists. But much like everywhere else, they were acutely aware that while their male counterparts were outwardly progressive in talking about equal rights, Angela, it was still the men who dominated in meetings and leadership positions.
Yeah, they were still making the tea. But while the same as in the US and Europe, the leaders of the feminist movement in Russia also tended to come from the middle and upper classes, and those with an education who resented being treated as these second-class citizens, there was one fundamental difference between the campaigns for suffrage in Russia and those in Europe, and that's that in the Russian Empire, there was no political freedom for men either.
Right.
Men or women.
At all.
Like, there was none at all. So it was slightly different to what the women...
They were starting from a lower base.
They were starting, exactly.
And it was kind of a tactical advantage for them, really, because they were pitching themselves as equals to men who also had no right to vote. This meant that they could embrace the call that universal suffrage meant everyone, without distinction of sex, making it a bit easier for the feminist movement to align with the socialist movement. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. So before we get on to what happened on International Women's Day in 1917 in Russia, maybe we should do a quick summary of where Russia was at the beginning of that year.
Okay.
Might be useful here. It's fair to say, pretty turbulent in the 1900s in Russia.
Yeah. The Russian Empire had been humiliated by its defeat in the Russo-Japanese War. And in 1905, a revolution erupted. Not the revolution, but a revolution.
Yeah.
It was marked by widespread strikes, protests, and a failed uprising against the autocratic rule of Tsar Nicholas II. And in response to the unrest, Nicholas II issued the October Manifesto, and that promised civil liberties and the establishment of a legislative assembly called the Duma.
Yeah, so it's all looking hopeful in 1905.
Yeah.
And in fact, the first major victory for feminism in the Russian Empire came in Finland in 1906. I don't know if you knew this, John.
I didn't know this.
So Finland was in a bit of a unique position in the Russian Empire because the Tsar was the Grand Duke of Finland. It had a slightly different relationship to other states in the Russian Empire. And Finland was starting its campaign for independence, really, at the time. So it wasn't like the other states. And on the 7th of July 1906, the Tsar signed off a law in Finland which gave women the right to vote. But not only that, also to run for office.
Wow.
And this was the first time that both those things had ever been achieved in the same country. So, yes, New Zealand was the first country to give women the vote, but they weren't allowed to run for office in New Zealand.
Wow. Okay.
Whereas Finland was the first place where they could vote and run for office.
Finland.
Wait, you were just looking, you weren't even listening to what I was saying then. You were just waiting. I'm just waiting for my opportunity to sing the Finland song from Monty Python. Just wait, I'll say it any minute now. She'll stop talking and then I can do my song.
I was concentrating. That's very interesting. I had no idea that this happened in Finland, However,
read your mind, John O'Farrell.
However, the socialist hopes for equality were dashed when in 1907, the Tsar enacted a new electoral law, ensuring that all future Dumas would remain under the control of the higher classes in society.
Ooh.
Yeah, and this sort of short-lived momentum for democracy in the Russian Empire seemed to be draining away.
Yeah, so it made little progress in the start of the century and then, just sort of started to fade pretty quickly. Russia had been partly industrialised, but because it had such a massive and spread out population, it was failing to meet the needs of that population, really. So, the people were suffering. And then in August 1914, Russia entered World War I on the side of the Allies.
Yes.
Now, at the beginning, most feminist publications in Russia, like elsewhere, were supportive of the war. They believed that if they were loyal to the war, then when it was over, they would get some sort of official gratitude and maybe then they'd be rewarded with some equal rights or whatever. Yeah. Bit naive.
By 1916, though, women's rights activists had gone from supporting the Tsar and the war to opposing them as they saw their standard of living rapidly decline. And they were told it was just something they had to endure.
Yeah, we're all suffering. Just get on with it.
Yeah.
Which brings us to 1917.
Ooh,
so
yes.
We're at the beginning of 1917, in St. Petersburg, rents had more than doubled. A pound of rye bread, which was a staple of a working class diet in St. Petersburg and a middle class diet in Clapham today, it rose from 3 kopecks in 1913 to 18 kopecks in 1917.
It's more kopecks than that in Gales in Clapham,
I can tell you. Yeah, I bet it is. It's insane. It's mad, isn't it? The poor people food we pay a fortune for
it's
now.
Rolled oats. It's rolled oats. That's what horse food.
So factories were closing because there was a lack of energy to actually run them.
Yeah.
Workers were facing layoffs and were striking. So it's pretty chaotic.
Yeah, but it was women who had to queue in the freezing lines for basic food like bread. Working class women were really struggling and this fueled their anger, not just with the Tsar, but with rich women who were able to come to the stores and exchange valuables and cash for food. And they would get supplies that were out of reach for poor families.
Yeah. There was a police report in St. Petersburg in January 1917 and it warned of imminent disturbances. A bit of an understatement.
We think there might be a spot of bother in Russia.
A little bit of trouble. This report said that mothers exhausted by standing in lines and tormented by their half-starving and sick children were extremely volatile and likely to rise up.
Well, it calmed down, dear.
But it's interesting that it was about the women. It was the women that were volatile, the women that were, you know. Then on the 8th of March 1917, along came International Women's Day. Well, it was 8th of March, this is confusing now, on the Western Gregorian calendar. But in Russia at the time, it was 23rd of February because they were still using the old-style Julian calendar, which is why the February Revolution is sometimes called the March Revolution, but it's the same.
I feel you should have let me do the, you know, well, actually, correcting thing. It's like, that really was an opportunity for me to come in.
We can't have a woman say the phrase, well, actually.
Yeah, no, that's not fair. I feel shortchanged by that, Andrew, if I'm honest. So the mostly male leaders among the socialists and liberals were not in favour of having demonstrations on International Women's Day in 1917. They basically wanted it on their agenda, not on the women's.
Yeah.
They did want to expend a lot of energy on women's rights at that particular moment because they were planning big workers' demonstrations and action for May Day when that came around.
Yeah, so they were saving themselves up for that. However, in direct defiance of orders from their male leaders, on that International Women's Day, female textile workers went out on strike. And then they sent delegates out to gather support. Yep. And pretty soon, tens of thousands of women were demonstrating throughout St. Petersburg. And their demands were threefold, John.
Yeah.
One, they wanted bread. Right. Two, they wanted peace. Right. And three, they wanted to be rid of the Tsar.
That's quite a lot, isn't it?
Quite a lot. Quite a big ask, really. So the demonstration actually would later become known as the Women's Strike for Bread and Peace. It's
right.
A famous sort of flashpoint.
Flashpoint, yes. Yeah. Initially, it was mostly just women marching, but they decided they didn't want to be alone. So they started going around the various factories, demanding their husbands, brothers and comrades came out and joined them. And they threw rocks and tiles at the factory windows, trying to disrupt and shame the men who were still working into coming out and join them in action.
Yeah, and it works. The factories started shutting down, thousands down tools. And soon about 250,000 were out on the street, marching through St. Petersburg, calling for a new government and the overthrow of the Tsar. I read in one piece that the weather actually contributed to what happened on that day in quite an interesting way, because it had been a proper Russian freezing winter, you know, for months on end, below freezing, considerably below freezing. And apparently on that particular day, the temperature shot up. It rose, John, to 7 degrees Celsius.
Oh, luxury.
Positively balmy. Because, I mean, 7 degrees would have me in my woolly hat. But when you've endured a Russian winter, that's going to feel quite tropical.
Put a spring costume on, yeah.
And so it suddenly felt like a spring day. And apparently that really contributed to people pouring into the streets and this sort of...
Yeah, it's mad, that, isn't it? How history can be changed by a bit of weather.
By a bit of
Also, many elements within the police and military were themselves on the verge of mutiny. They sympathised with the demonstrators. And when they were ordered to fire on the mostly female protesters, they couldn't bring themselves to do it. And the women were calling to them, "We are your wives, your mothers, don't fight, join us." And many of them did.
Yeah. So by the end of that International Women's Day, there's no going back, John, whether the socialist leaders liked it or not.
Right.
There was to be no waiting for May Day to come around for their planned demonstrations. They were happening.
Yeah.
The women had forced the issue. It was happening right now. So they hadn't planned for it or expected it, and they weren't the driving force behind it. But the Russian February Revolution, or March Revolution, depending how you want to look at it, the calendars, it was underway.
That's amazing. I never knew that was because of International Women's Day. Or
funny that, isn't it? That the men sort of wrote that little fact.
They wanted to have it on May, but the women had it in February or March. That's cool. On February the 25th, 2 days after the women's insurrection began, the Tsar ordered General Kabalov of the military district to shoot, if necessary, to crush the uprising. Kabalov said, "When they said, 'Give us bread,' we could give them bread, and that was the end of it. But when they said, 'Down with autocracy,' we could no longer appease them with bread."
So the Tsar had lost control of St. Petersburg, and he would be told in no uncertain terms that the only option left to him, John, was abdication. Aww. Get out. And 4 days later, that's what he did. He abdicated. A provisional government formed to rule until the Constituent Assembly became the first government of a major power to give women the right to vote in 1918.
Wow. And with Clara Zetkin's help, Lenin went on to establish International Women's Day as an official communist holiday in 1922, which was also when Chinese communists started to celebrate it.
Yeah, that's right. So it became a communist holiday on International Women's Day in Spain in 1936, following the victory of the Popular Front Coalition. In the February elections, La Pasionaria, one of the leaders of the Spanish Communist Party, led thousands of women to demonstrate in Madrid to demand protection of the Republic against the growing fascist threat.
Right. And then after World War II, International Women's Day remained primarily a communist holiday. After the founding of the People's Republic of China on October the 1st, 1949, the State Council proclaimed that March the 8th would be made an official holiday with women getting half a day off. Fantastic.
Yeah, look at that. Half a day. Oh, half a day off, Josh. On May the 8th, 1965, so we're getting a bit later now in the century, the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, which was the highest executive and administrative organ of power in the Soviet Union, decreed International Women's Day a non-working day in the USSR. Quote, John, you can read this bit.
In commemoration of the outstanding merits of Soviet women in communistic construction, in the defense of their fatherland during the Great Patriotic War, in the heroism and selflessness at the front and in the rear, and also marking the great contribution of women to strengthening friendship between peoples and the struggle for peace.
Soviets never said anything in three words that they could say in 300, did they?
I think they could use gagging up a bit, I would say.
It needs a little bit of something. However, it does seem International Women's Day in Russia from that point was sort of treated a bit like Mother's Day. Kind of buying them flowers, take them out for a meal. Hopefully that means they won't moan for the rest of the year, am I right? Not sure that's exactly what the original organisers meant it to be, but that's what it sort of became in Soviet states. And hence the mimosas. It was a bit like, give them some flowers, shut them up.
Nice yellow flowers, shut up. Outside of the communist countries, International Women's Day wasn't really marked at all until later, was it?
No.
The middle of the 20th century, the idea of having an International Women's Day was being revived in the West as a day of activism, sometimes known in Europe as the Women's International Day of Struggle.
Yeah, but there were concerns, John.
Oh,
unsurprisingly, America wasn't too happy about this.
Yes.
Slightly communist beginnings of International Women's Day. So do you know what they did? I didn't know this either. No. This is fascinating. In the sort of 50s, 60s, when they started to revive in the West this idea of having an International Women's Day, America decided to cover up the fact it was a communist holiday and it had communist roots, socialist roots. So until the 1980s, the official International Women's Day story went that the day was conceived in 1909, which it was, but that it took place on the 8th of March, not because that's the day the women's strike kicked off the Russian Revolution, but because the date commemorated a protest by female garment workers that had taken place in New York in 1857.
Except that isn't true.
No. Yeah,
according to research in the early 1980s, the New York City garment workers' demonstration in 1857 never happened. It was just a myth devised in 1955.
Yeah, so at the height of the Red Scare in the US, of course, they couldn't tell people what.
So just to detach the origins of International Women's Day from its socialist beginnings.
Mad,
I love that they still did it with a strike. You think they could have done it with a little church, putting the flowers in the church or, you know.
But it's mad that it just, for several decades, people thought that was the beginning of the International Women's Day. It was in the 80s. It was a French researcher went, hang on a minute, that never happened.
That's
that strike never happened.
Yeah.
So for International Women's Day in the 70s and 80s, women's rights groups were joined by socialist and labour organisations to call for equal pay, equal economic opportunity, equal legal rights, reproductive rights, subsidised childcare and the prevention of violence against women. The feminism, second wave feminism, as we understand it.
Yeah. United Nations began officially celebrating International Women's Day in 1975, which had been proclaimed International Women's Year.
It's hard to believe, John, that any year in the 70s was that good for women. Oh, lucky women. It's 1975. It really is the year of the woman, isn't it? Wear a skirt and high heels to work and don't mind if your boss taps you on the arse on the way out. That's fine.
Oh, God, yeah, the 70s were not a great time for women.
No.
And, of course, today it's as commercialised, really, as any other international day. An excuse for companies to market their shit to women seems to have taken the place of real promotion of radical socialist reforms.
Yeah. To be honest, John, in the last 10 years, I've mostly celebrated International Women's Day by watching Richard Herring on Twitter, replying to every idiot that tweets, when's it International Men's Day? And he just goes through all of them and says it's on the 19th of November.
It's sort of heroic, actually, what Herring does there.
Well, I don't like using the word heroic about a man on International Women's Day, really.
But he's sort of relentless in his...
It's funny.
It is funny, and he does raise money for...
We don't really need him to save us. It's fine.
No, no. But he does raise money for women's refuges,
does,
I think. And
does,
things.
Does,
and also, my daughter always does this thing on her Volga Drawings Instagram, which is a highlight in all those companies you were talking about. So it's like this International Women's Day, you know, of 10% off makeup and nail varnish.
It always is. And this International Women's Day will sell you a pink screwdriver.
Exactly what
it
is.
Are you lucky?
Yeah. Well, I've genuinely learned stuff there, Angela. I didn't know anything about. And I think, well done. Well done.
Thanks, John. I did a good job, didn't I?
At this. No, the whole thing about the Russian Revolution being tied up, I had no idea about that. The march thing came from women's protests. And I didn't know that nonsense from America about the making up a piece of history just to stop it being, you know, communist. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So that's it, I think, for our International Women's Day. I had to help you a little bit, Angela.
I did, but I appreciate that, John.
But
thank
you. I sort of guided you through, I think, really.
You did, really. Yeah, you sort of led the way, but I did my best.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think it was well typed. It was well typed. Oh, I'm glad there's a table in between us. You've had some nice...
It's a good job I know you, John, isn't it?
We've had lots of lovely feedback.
John, I had a lovely thing happen the other day. Yeah. And if you're listening, I didn't get your name, but I was walking through King's Cross with my friend Andrea, and a lovely lady came over to me and said, "I really love your podcast."
So nice.
And it's nice because it's sort of, people don't tend to mention the podcast in the, you know, in that way.
Great.
So it really made my day, that
That's
did.
Great. It's
so
lovely.
Thank you, whoever you were, for that.
Somebody came up to me in Clapham High Street and said how much they liked our podcast as well. Oh. So that's great when it happens. You can also say you like it with a review.
That was smooth. I enjoyed that.
See the way I segued in there? You can give us 5 stars instead of just saying it to us in King's Cross. Hanging around King's Cross to catch Angela. That's creepy.
I'm not always in King's Cross, by the way. Yeah. Just in case you were thinking, oh, well, I'll head down to King's Cross and tell her. It's not where I just hang out. I just happened to be there that day.
So give us a review, tell your friends, and
don't forget our Patreon if you would like some extra content and ad-free episodes, and you get your episode a week early and all that stuff. So you go to patreon.com/wearehistory. John looked at me then going, please don't ask me to say the website because I can't remember what it is. I could read that in your eyes,
oh,
John.
God.
You were like, please don't throw to me to give the website. There's no way I'm going to remember
it. www. That's it for this week's episode. Have a great International Women's Day.
Yes, please do. And British Pie Week. Enjoy that
British
as well.
British Pie Week, that's the main thing, isn't it, really?
Love a pie.
Oh, love a pie.
Let's go and have a pie.
All right.
Bye.
See you next time.
History was written and presented by Angela Barnes and John O'Farrell. The producer was me, Simon Williams. The group editor was Andrew Harrison. Socials were by Kieran Leslie. And artwork was by James Parrott. We Are History is a Podmasters production.